you have an active intellectual life? That is a question you may feel uncomfortable answering these days, given that the very phrase intellectual life can strike some people as pretentious or self-indulgent, even irresponsible in a time of pandemic disease. But what better time could there be for examination of the subject of the inner life? And what is the intellectual life anyway? In her 2020 book, Lost in Thought, The Hidden Pleasures of an Intellectual Life, Zena Hitz explores the interior world and shows that intellectual endeavor is not simply a matter of reading by oneself, but can encompass everything from a lifelong fascination with falcons to strategies for attaining one's sanity and humanity in a gulag, or producing groundbreaking political and sociological writings in a prison cell in Mussolini's Italy. In the course of her book, Hitz deploys real-world examples from young Einstein in his job in a Swiss patent office to Malcolm X's encounter with a fellow prison inmate who first urged him to embark on a life-changing course of reading, to Dorothy Day's encounters with books throughout her life and their influence on her youthful secular radicalism, to her conversion to Catholicism and continued activism. We also encounter St. Augustine and take a deep dive into Elena Ferrante's Neapolitan novels and travel with a Preston Sturgeon hero in a screwball comedy / social commentary film. Hitz's reader-friendly examination of the intellectual life is ideal reading for the millions of us confined to our homes due to the coronavirus and who now have time to read and to think seriously about matters of mortality and the meaning of life, which are suddenly front and center in our daily lives. And at a time of pandemic-related economic peril for liberal arts colleges and programs, Hitz has taken what ailed them even before our current crisis and a prescription for a way forward for those that survive in the next several years are must-reading for not only academics but all citizens who care about how civilization itself carries on. Give a listen. Hello, everyone. My name is Hope J. Lehman, and I'm one of the hosts of the New Books Network. I'm talking today with Zena Hitz, author of the 2020 book Lost in Thought, The Hidden Pleasures of an Intellectual Life. Thank you for joining us today, Zena. Let's get started with the title of your book, which is charming, by the way.
Oh, thank you. And I just want to say thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Well, thank you. And this is your debut on the New Books Network.
It's my debut. That's right.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm thrilled. This is a very we're a very intellectually oriented audience. So you are the perfect guest. So on the title of your book, as we know, which is, I'm going to read it again. Lost in Thought, The Hidden Pleasures of an Intellectual Life. Let's start with the title, which is, as we say, charming. What do you mean by the word hidden in it? And I'm going to be this is a really long question. So do you mean that here we go, audience. Thank you for your patience. Do you mean by hidden that many of us don't even realize that some of our activities are manifestations of an intellectual life and might be surprised that something we regard as a hobby or special interest of our own is actually a form of intellectual life? Alternatively, do you mean hidden in that some of us don't share with others our intellectual passions for fear of seeming eccentric or self-centered? Or do you mean hidden in that the world at large regards the intellectual life as involving book learning and belonging mostly to academia and think tanks and is therefore hidden from public view? You say in the book this about learning, it begins in hiding. You use the word invisible towards the end of the book, writing, the invisible life has all the human splendor of the visible one and often more. Is there a difference in your mind between the hidden and the invisible? Over to you, Zena.
Well, thanks so much. That's a great question. I don't think I did mean a difference between hidden and invisible. I think I meant them the same way. Mm-hmm. And I think I want to say it's a little closer to the third of your options. So it's certainly true that the kind of activity I'm interested in is something we can carry on without taking it fully seriously. So someone may read and think or study plants or animals as a kind of a hobby without thinking of themselves as being an intellectual. So that's true. The main thing I wanted to capture by hidden or by invisible is the inwardness of intellectual life, that it is essentially something that begins in an inner life, in inner dialogue, in inner reflection, in private. It begins there. Now, it doesn't have to end there, obviously. I also think intellectual friendship, intellectual community, that's all very important too. But at the end, you need, there has to be this confrontation of the individual heart and mind with whatever it is that they're thinking about or wondering about. That's fundamental. So hiddenness in that way, because it's inward and because it's part of our inner lives, it may or may not manifest outwardly. So our closest friends and relatives may not know what we're thinking about or pondering. It may manifest itself in books or articles or in an academic career, and it may not. So it's part of it is the idea is that intellectual life in its original sense, in its primary sense, is something that really is whose value doesn't depend on the results. It's not something which necessarily has a product that's visible to the outside world. And that, I think, is important for thinking about what it is and why it really matters to us.
That's very helpful. Now that we've discussed the word hidden, let's discuss what you mean by intellectual and the intellectual life. Is there a difference, and you mentioned this, is there a difference between that and the inner life? At what stage of life do most people commence having an intellectual life? I know I was fascinated that you said your brother taught you to read, for example, which is kind of unusual.
Yes, indeed it was.
how old was he and how old were you?
I'm not quite sure how to separate the legend from the fact. So I think the legend is that he was 4 and I was 2. That sounds a little implausible to me. So I'm not really sure, but it's true that I can't remember not knowing how to read. So it was sometime before the advent of my conscious memory.
And your parents back you up on that, that your brother taught you.
That it comes from them, and the legend too about him, me being 2 and him being 4 also comes from them. So again, I don't know. Sometimes these stories turn out not to be true, but I think it is different for different people. So I try very much in my book to present a big tent picture of the intellectual life. So we were a very unusually nerdy family. We read a lot. We argued a lot. We talked about things. We liked facts and science and math and all kinds of things. And of course, as is not unusual, I became a professional intellectual and academic. So that's only a few people are ever going to be interested to that degree or to that intensity or really find that they're going to spend a career doing it. But I think everyone, I'm very comfortable saying, everyone to court has an inner life. They all have a space within them where they reflect or contemplate or savor or encounter certain things on their own in an unmediated way. And I think that what I've gone back and forth over the course of my thinking about this as to whether everyone also has an intellectual life or whether... whether I want to set aside, say, someone who, say, an ordinary churchgoer whose inner life consists of prayer, is that an intellectual life? Well, in some ways it might be. You're contemplating, you're thinking about God, you're reading the scriptures, but it's not, it may be less intellectual in some people than in others. So again, I can go either way on something like that. I want to be confident that inwardness belongs to everybody. Intellectual life, I think, certainly belongs to most people. And if you understand inwardness in a certain way, to everyone also. That's a little bit roundabout, but that's, I think, what I want to say about it right now.
Well, I won't press you further then.
you could feel free to press me further. That's part of what this is about. Put me against the wall. It's fine.
Well, all right. All right. This next question is a little bit pressing you a bit.
Oh, perfect.
You use the word pleasures in the title of your book, and yet in it you have a section in the book called asceticism. And right there, intellectual life turns out to be a sort of asceticism, and as in ascetic, as in difficult. And go on to say, intellectual life is a discipline, the product of hard work and practice in a sort of self-denial. That doesn't sound very pleasurable to me. Could you explain to us the seeming contradiction?
Well, I'll have to maybe I shouldn't say this. The pleasures part of the title was actually something I tried to argue with the marketing people at the press about for just this reason. I thought it would be misleading given how much I talk about suffering and sacrifice and asceticism in the book. However, here's why I think it is a good title in the end. I do think asceticism is important, and by that I mean something like this. It's fundamental to intellectual activity that something be sacrificed. So for instance, here's a common example. You really believe something's true. You really want to believe it's true. You undertake an investigation, say to prove it to someone else, and you look at the evidence and you think it over and you realize it's not true. Now, that's a painful feeling, but it is universal to any kind of intellectual endeavor, just as it is to, and I say this in the book, any kind of work. You know, you're a woodworker. There are certain kinds of wood that are just not going to do what you want them to do. There are certain kinds of ways of cutting it or ways of putting wood together that are not going to work. So intellectual activity is like that. It has an inbuilt sacrifice to it, an inbuilt suffering. What I also want to say, and what maybe is more fundamental, is that it involves, in order to get to what I'm calling the core of intellectual life or the roots of intellectual life, you have to get past the pursuit of status, of power, of career advancement, of money. And that is really a fundamental kind of asceticism. So I think that one of the things that happens when people encounter my work, and I have a lot of examples in the book of very noble, heroic figures who read and think in the most adverse of circumstances. And a natural reaction is to say, well, you know, I've met some people who were intellectuals who were really not particularly noble or heroic or particularly kind or particularly plugged into their community. They were arrogant, selfish jerks. You know, what do you say about that? So I have to, part of my thought about asceticism is that it's a way of understanding what can go wrong with the intellectual life. That is, if it's mixed with desires for status, desires for money, desires for social advancement, then I think you start to get something different. So, yeah. But now, see, you were worried you were going to talk too much, but now I feel like I am talking too much. The thing I wanted to say about the joys or the pleasures of the intellectual life is that despite that suffering that's right there at the outset, at entry level, so to speak, you know, you have to give up looking good, you have to give up your pride, you have to give up, you have to appear ignorant, you have to face your own ignorance, all these things are painful. At the end of that, there's a real desire to understand something and to savor it. And that desire is where the real pleasure comes from, where the real joys of the intellect are. So it's not suffering for suffering's sake. It's suffering for the sake of something else. It's like the pleasures of intellectual life are like the pleasures of being an being an athlete, where you suffer a lot. You know, you diet, you train, you have to deal with aggressive coaches, but then you have the pleasure of achievement, which is something that's only available when you sacrifice other things.
The sort of intellectual equivalent of no pain, no gain.
Something like that. Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Well, now that we've discussed pleasures, a related concept to that is leisure. Mm-hmm. And could you please discuss what you mean by leisure, and how would you characterize what is happening now to millions of people living under coronavirus-related shutdowns? Is that a kind of, we're sort of in a state of involuntary, enforced leisure, if you say in terms of time?
Yeah.
And then you refer in the book to Lauren Smiley's 2015 essay, The Shut-In Economy. Mm-hmm. And aren't we lucky in a way, since we're at home, that we have access to the kind of web-based services that Smiley seems to disdain? I mean, she says, well, people are becoming sort of workaholic slaves of the service economy because they're able to stay home. But those are kind of our salvation at this point because we can't go home. I mean,
right.
We have to stay home. We can't go out.
Yes. So I think that, yeah, I wonder, I haven't looked up what Lauren Smiley's been writing recently. I wonder if she's been writing about this. I think the point of the Smiley essay, and a point that I also try to make in an essay and also in a blog post I wrote recently in response to how leisure fits with a coronavirus, it's actually not enough for the leisure that I'm interested in to be simply confined to your house or even to be isolated, because you can spend, as in the essay, the Smiley essay, you can spend tons of time on your work. You can actually work night and day. So one of the things that happens, I think, in quarantine is, on the one hand, there's an enormous opportunity to restructure one's life, you know, and we see this, some, you know, people get into gardening and they get into bread baking and all this kind of stuff, simplicity. And then we also have a tendency to just live our entire lives online, mm-hmm. work for endless hours, and then, you know, switch over into screen distractions, Netflix, and so on. And I don't think that's leisurely in the sense I mean it. So let me say, you asked originally what leisure was, so let me say something about what I think it is. It has to be an activity, a space that's away from what's useful to you, and a place where it feels like what you're doing in leisure is certain activities that are undertaken for their own sake, and that I want to put a little more weight on them. It's not just something you do for its own sake, like there are wonderful recreational activities, playing cards or you know, badminton in the yard or all kinds of things like that. It's not quite sufficient to say that because you're not doing those things for the sake of something else, they count as leisure. I want to say that a leisured activity is one that could count as the culmination of a life. So it's a moment where you sit back and you say to yourself, you know, the time stops going by, you're lost in what you're doing, and you say, and reflecting later or in the moment, you can say, this is what, I need nothing more than this right now. So some examples are, for many people, time spent with your family. You know, it's, you're just being together. You're not producing anything. You're spending, you're sitting by the fireside in the winter chatting, or you're goofing around in the yard in the summer, thinking, reading, studying, reflecting. Those can be done really for their own sake, and you can get lost in them, and they can feel like what your life really culminates in. Creative activity, that's another example, music or art. So I think these are, or again, if you think about ordinary churchgoers, their time in church, their time in prayer, maybe a time of leisure, a time of rest. So it's that that I think needs to be safeguarded, not just from the demands of ordinary work in ordinary times when we leave the house and stay at the office too late, but actually in a way even more now because we're so subject to distractions because so much of work is being done online. And it can be a, I don't know quite how to, it can make your, it can make you frantic and anxious and unable to really savor what's in your immediate surroundings.
Yeah, it's interesting that some employers, it was a big controversy about maybe 10 years ago when the incoming head of Yahoo said, no more working at home. Right. And now the opposite has happened, that Twitter is saying, oh, you don't have to come back to workplace ever. It's just great. and so it's as though the employers have said, gosh, you know, we can just absolve ourselves of any interest in their lives at all except the work product. And,
no, that's right. But I think that, at least I hope, that even those workplaces understand that there's some collaboration that really only works in person. And, you know, it's amazing how much we can do with technology at home. It's incredible. But I do think, especially in my field, you know, in education, the in-person classroom, the in-person faculty meeting, it has benefits that really can't be totally replicated outside of it. So we have to do this for now, and I think we all recognize the necessity of that. But there are costs that I hope that we'll remember and come back to.
Okay. Well, speaking of the workplace and economics and so forth, and as you mentioned, that I could put you against the wall, but you were talking about we're talking about business and economics, and I get the impression from your work, from your book, that you feel that money itself are somewhat incompatible with the intellectual life. I mean, money and business in particular. But I just wanted to point out that people in finance related fields, for example, and investment banking, those people in that field are actively engaged in highly creative, intellectually rewarding endeavors. I mean, they're just technology, geopolitics. Many of the people you knew in college went into such fields or left careers in academics in academia to go into them. They left academia. Did those people become less interesting and engaged in to you? And also, status seeking, while not necessarily admirable, requires a great deal of intellectual work. I mean, you have to just a scheming is a form of intellectual work. I mean, being and totally devoting, you know, being a slimy, ambitious person, that they're also intelligent people. Did those who sought worldly success become to you dull conversationalists and not the sparkling intellects you recalled them as? Or at what point, I'd like to ask, when you meet someone, can you tell they're intellectually interesting or merely posers?
Oh, that's a great question. So let me hang on to that last question and answer the first question first, which I think is really fundamental. Because I actually really do not want to say that somehow being a banker or a businessman or a politician is somehow incompatible with intellectual life. I don't think that at all. And I don't think that for two reasons. Now, one, it requires a little more nuance. So I talk early on in the book about instrumental uses of the mind. So you're using your mind, you're using it very intensely. You're using it with a great deal sometimes of, with, you know, it may require great virtues and great habit building and great insight, but you're using it as a means to an end. So you're working on Wall Street, you're using every neuron you have to figure out, you know, what to buy, what to sell, et cetera. If you're a engineer, it's very intellectually interesting work, you know, to figure out how to organize a warehouse or how to build a bridge. So I'm not denying that those are somehow works of the mind or denying that they're important. What I do want to try to rescue in our culture is that the mind is more than that. So there's a use of the mind, so to speak, an activity of the mind that's not a means to an end, but that's worth pursuing for its own sake. So that's why, you know, that's the intellectual life of bookworms, of housewives in their corners sneaking time to think about something. That's the intellectual life of the prisoners I talk about in the book who undertake these intellectual endeavors. They're doing something for its own sake, not because there's a product, not because it's going to advance them necessarily in the world or make them money, but just because it makes them a different kind of person. So in a way, part of what the distinction here is, which I haven't put in the writing before, but I've been thinking about it a bit, is part of it is a difference between thinking about yourself as a person who does something, who has a particular type of work, and as a person who is a certain kind of a person, who has something with them inbuilt into their characters, inbuilt into their minds, which makes you who you are and which you carry with you no matter what happens to you, even in really adverse circumstances. So that's I think the first thing I want to say, that I'm not denying the intellectual sophistication of many, many, many instrumental activities. The other thing I'm not denying is that in intellectual life, in my sense, intellectual life for its own sake, it's certainly available to people who work in any profession. They can work on Wall Street, they can be engineers, they can be taxi drivers, they can be politicians. One anecdote I like to talk about is I have this memory from it's St. John's. We have this, where I teach, we have this tradition of Friday night lectures, which are open to the public. And this, some years ago, there was a Friday night lecture by one of my colleagues, who was also one of my classmates, and it was on Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher's theory of music. So what did Kant think about music? Now, not a lot of topics that would be less relevant, cutting edge, interesting. Really, if you're only interested in this because you like to think about stuff and you like to think about what music is. So two of his classmates, who I also knew, came in from DC. Now, one of them at that time was a very, very high-ranking staffer on Capitol Hill. The other one was a lobbyist, total opposite ends of the political spectrum. So one of them could not have been more right-wing. The other one could not have been more left-wing. They came, they drove in together from DC. They were classmates, and they loved sitting in this lecture, listening to Kant on music. And to me, that was so touching. That's a sign of the kind of thing that I'm thinking about for intellectual life, that it's this core that's inward and that's removed in some way from your work in the world, but where there's a piece of your humanity in that is not necessarily captured in whatever you're doing when you're fighting for causes in Washington. So that's I think that should help. I don't know if that helps with the first part of your question.
I'd like to ask about did it help that it was a joint enjoyment that Kant was talking about, that was about Kant's views of music and not Kant's view of morality or anything else? The music is sort of an end-line.
Well, even I do think, honestly, this is one of the things I secretly think. Actually, it's not so secret. I put it in writing. I do think that one of the things that can help, you were talking last week with Yuval Levin about polarization, political polarization. And, it's widely thought that this is a problem in contemporary society, and I agree with that. I think a lot of it is actually just what people talk about. So, if you talk about things which are bigger, deeper, richer, more profound, more fundamental, you tend to get past the partisan differences pretty fast. And I think that even happens with Kant's moral theory. It's not obviously, a pawn in any of our contemporary fights. The more you study it, the more you think about it, you can see how it has a certain connection with Enlightenment liberalism and so on. So there's a lot to be said about it, but it doesn't, if you're thinking hard about something that's really fundamental, it's really just a different kind of activity than that kind of squabbling, bickering, back and forth. I think this, no, you think this. That's, I think, part of what I'm trying to recover. Now, I can also answer the poser question when you like. I wanted to give you a chance to come back to what I just was talking about.
Well, I think that it's difficult because I was just thinking as you were talking about the big questions. Well, I think, abortion, you couldn't get much bigger than that because it's a fundamental, what is life or when does life begin? And that, so it, I guess... Yeah, I guess it's difficult to say what you can talk about, what you avoid. You don't want to trivialize life entirely, but you also, you got me thinking about that.
Well, I see what you're saying, and that's actually a great example. So because in a way, I think you must be right. Abortion and euthanasia, they certainly touch on questions about what human life is for and what a human being is. Although I honestly think that most people's positions on those issues are, they're settled further back on some kind of way of thinking about what matters in a human life. If you are willing to, in a particular conversation, now, sometimes you have to argue about abortion. So, you got a Supreme Court case, you're a lawyer, you've got to do it. You're a politician, you've got to do it. But as to whether recreationally such a production conversation is worthwhile or educationally, I think you have to wonder whether it might be more worthwhile to get behind that question to something more fundamental and where there might be a real common core of exchange where people's anxieties go down, their emotions go down, and they can really think through, what do they think a human life is for? Is it something that's really rooted in your body? And what would it really mean if it weren't? What are the ways in which we identify ourselves with our consciousness, our memory of our biography, and what are the senses in which we don't? And in my experience teaching at St. John's, which has a very diverse student body, politically and religiously diverse, I don't find that we have little struggles here and there, usually outside the classroom on political disagreements. But for the most part, because we're focused on these bigger questions and the deeper questions and the difficulties of working through a very complex work or a very complex thinker, we tend to leave those things at the door and go somewhere else. And I think that's an underrated approach to these kinds of questions, to talk about something else that's more fundamental and where there can be dialogue. That's my way of thinking about these things.
Well, one of the issues that came up as I read your book was the distinction between contemplation and learning. And it sounds like like you want your students to contemplate. Is there a distinction? Could you flesh that out a little
bit? Actually, that's too
abstruse.
No, that's actually a great question, because I think I'm pretty confident that I play fast and loose with both those words in my book. So they are worthy of untangling. I mean, learning is progress, right? It's moving from one place to another. That's learning. And contemplation is the culminating point. You know, you contemplate the theorem you've just proved, or you contemplate the splendor of the character of this novel you just read. So that's, I think, the simple difference between them.
Well, at what point when you're dealing with students or colleagues, or when you were a student, did you, getting back to the question of someone's actually interesting or intellectually substantive to say, and when are they just blowhards?
You know, see, I think that's a great question. And I definitely don't want to say, and it connects, and it was certainly back to the question about hiddenness and why I want to call the intellectual life hidden. You know, every year, I admit this, maybe I shouldn't admit it in public, but I will. Every year, I meet my students at the beginning of the year, and I just naturally, automatically, without thinking about it, I stereotype them. This is a blowhard. You know, this is a phony. Oh, this is a good student, quote unquote, good student. And I have to say, those views tend to be completely obliterated within a matter of time. Hmm. And it's often true that students who, even who I've known for quite a long time, will suddenly surprise me with some depth that they'd chosen not to display before. So it's not so much about dividing people into types. You know, this person's a phony, this person's a blowhard, this person's the real deal, this person's a real intellectual. I've found that, as I reached middle age, less and less useful. I find that people are always surprising me. On the other hand, there are signs of when a particular student speaking is speaking authentically or is speaking to impress. And I think, honestly, what are the signs? You know, is there a way of detecting or explaining why it is that you think that someone is faking it or is doing the real thing? One sign, of course, is smoothness, polish, long words, terminology, referring to knowledge that isn't shared with a room. The word, this is a bit of a joke, but there's something in it. The word actually. Someone says, well, actually, you know, the Greeks didn't have a concept of, you know, that's to me, instantly I've turned off. I assume this person is just talking stuff. So humility is really a key to an authentic intellectual life. You have to be willing to acknowledge to yourself and often to others what you don't understand and be willing to change in the face of evidence. That's difficult for us. It's difficult for students, especially contemporary young people. They have a lot more trouble being wrong than even I did when I was young. But that, I think, is kind of the mark of authenticity. Can someone accept that they don't know something? Can they accept the limitations of what they're saying? Are they willing to progress or to move forward or to move backward? That, to me, are the signs that someone's doing the real thing. Yeah.
Well, that's very helpful, because I know that you were a fellow at the James Madison program at Princeton, the James Madison program in American Ideals and Institutions. And Robert George is very, a large part of he's the director and founder, as you know. And a large part of what he does with Cornell West when they both travel the country is they say, Robert George in particular emphasizes intellectual humility. And also you have a very moving passage, and I'll look for it as you're speaking about there's a passage in the book about the disorientation of realizing that you might be wrong. And that's a big part of what he does. And I was really struck by that in your book about the fact that it's not a pleasant experience. And I guess that gets back to what you were just saying about it's important to be not to be open to that.
No, I think that's right. And I think that it's fundamental to not just to liberal arts education, but to education in general. I mean, I'm from the humanities and I tend to talk with a humanities focus. A lot of things we're talking about are also true for scientists and mathematicians. They have to be able to go back and test their hypothesis and see whether it really works or not. They have to be open to data that don't fit the model. It's just crucial. And I think it's one of the things that can distinguish, it's one of the tensions between practical thinking, where you're doing some thinking in order to achieve a certain object, whether that's a product or a political object or what have you, and thinking for its own sake. Because if you're thinking as a means to an end, that end might obscure to you whether you're making all the right steps. Now that's more true in thinking than it is in real life. You know, in real life, you meet some materials, manual work, I mean, not really real life. Manual work, you just can't bake bread without yeast, okay? It's just not going to work. But you can fabricate a theory out of words that sounds good, that gets lots of attention, that makes you money, that makes you famous. And in the bottom of it, there's nothing. And you have to be aware of that possibility and you have to guard against it at all times, because our capacity to be deceived is extremely high. And that's part of why intellectual life is so crucial for our happiness and well-being.
Well, I found the quotes from the book that you talk about the intellectual humility that you're discussing. And you write, this is from your book, it says, "Consider the self-awareness induced by a powerful argument on a subject one cares deeply about, the sometimes sudden disorientation that results when one realizes that one might be wrong." And you also write, "When we think and reflect, we struggle to allow our desire for truth to prevail over the desires that conflict with truth." And that's, yeah, I think that, what do you mean that's not true? That's what I've lived with all my life, and that's what my parents taught me, and how can that not be true?
That's exactly right. And I think for me, as someone who, my intellectual origins in a certain way were thinking about, because I'm a convert, right, to the Catholic Church. So I had to undergo as an adult, it wasn't actually even the first major change of mind. When I was younger, I changed my mind a lot about very fundamental things. And it was just this kind of concern that somehow I might be living my life by something which was really not true. And how was I going to know? And it's hard work, harder work than we might think.
Well, skipping to that topic, I'd like to discuss your religious writing. I mean, you write about religion, not as a religious book. It's not a religious book. It's a book for everyone. But you write on the topic of religion, you write this: "The charge that religion is anti-intellectual is widespread and ancient." And you write that you converted Catholicism very much on your own, giving that hardly anyone in your family had any sort of religious feeling or any institutional relationship to a church. And how much a part of your conversion was due to the rich intellectual heritage of the Catholic Church, or how much was it more deep spiritual yearning? I would think the latter, because that's what you discuss more in the book than the fact that there are although you do discuss Augustine and I believe Aquinas as well. I'll just blather on.
No, you're not bothering at all. Go ahead.
Well, I was wondering, were any of your professors Catholics who modeled for you what a Catholic intellectual could be? And if so, what values did they embody that you wanted to emulate? And do you think you've succeeded in emulating them? Is there anything special that Catholic intellectuals have to offer, not only Catholics, but everyone else, especially during the pandemic? Or was your Catholicism very much, was a bifurcation? This is my intellectual life. This is my religious life. They didn't spill over. For example, when you went to a religious retreat, I noticed that there you were deeply involved in your faith and your conversion process and the Catholicism, but you were not reading a lot. In fact, your reading was copies of the New Yorker and some articles that your colleagues would send you, but you were sort of hungry for some substantial reading, right? Or are we trying to just swear off it for a time in the retreat? Or the religious community, I could say it wasn't a retreat. It was 3 years. It wasn't just a 3 month thing.
No, it's true. Well, in a certain way, it was, I suppose, like a retreat in the way that it finally worked out. It spent some time in the desert fighting with demons and then came back out again. I think so. Initially, let me start with the biographical question. Initially, I have to say it was not, as you're quite right, it was not an intellectual conversion. I think it would have been hard for that to work for me at that time because I had just been through philosophy grad school and had met all kinds of extremely intelligent people who argued for all kinds of crazy views. I mean, views that they knew were crazy. I mean, there were people that didn't believe in parts, and there were people that believed that...
Didn't believe in parts.
They didn't believe in the part-whole relation. So everything was corpuscles. There were people who didn't, who thought that... Anyway, crazy metaphysical views about the way the world works. Very, very intelligent people, much, much smarter than I was in an obvious way. And so... that made it hard for me to see reasoning as a way into the truth. That is, I didn't see how an argument could convince you that something was really true because these people had generated arguments for things that to me were obviously not true. So part of what, I think my interest in the church really was a different, what you're calling a spiritual yearning. I think that's right. I wanted to be a member of a community. I wanted to have a religion. I was curious in a lot of ways. I had this affinity with religious people. I had friendships with religious people, and I felt like I was like them in some way, but I didn't know how to articulate it. So it felt very natural for me coming into the Catholic Church for the most part. It was very very easy transition. It was hard once I was in because as time went on, I realized how radical the faith really is and how counter to world, the world and worldly values it is. And that crisis, of course, led to my going to the religious community for a time. But I guess I do think that, how do I want to put it? So... I do think that Catholic intellectuals are extremely important right now. Or in a certain way, I want to be a little more ecumenical. I think religious intellectuals are very important right now. And I think that that's true because...
When you say right now, what is the what right now meaning? The COVID crisis or just the 21st century? Or?
Yeah, maybe I'm not really saying much. Maybe what I really mean is you always need the Mass. I don't know if I have any particular...
They're important now. They're always important.
It's always important. Here's what I think. Right now, given that so much of our intellectual culture is very, very secular and very disconnected from... So not just secular, but disconnected from questions about ordinary life.
Or even actively anti-religious.
Anti-religious, but really I think...
Aggressively.
Aggressively anti-religious. That I think can't be, that creates my impression at this point, having been, a Catholic intellectual now for 14 years or whatever it is. I actually don't think the number of people that are aggressively anti-religion is that high, but they have an outsized impact because they create a climate of fear. So one of the things that's happened to me as I've, and this is one of the reasons why I think it's important that there be such people, one of the things that's happened to me since I've become openly Catholic intellectual is that people will come up to me who are not openly religious and they'll talk to me about what they care about as far as religion. It's not always something that anyone in their professional world knows. So the aggressive atheism has created a kind of climate of fear where people are unwilling to speak openly about things that they care about. And these are things which are fundamental, right or wrong, true or false. They're fundamental to how we live our lives. I mean, these are questions that have to be grappled with. They are, in a certain way, the original fundamental questions. You know, is the world created? Does my life have a purpose? Is death the end? I mean, you know, what's, is a human being fundamentally good or fundamentally bad? These are just basic questions on which religion is an extremely valuable resource, even for people who might find it hard to actually get on board. So I think it's crucial as a way for people to help people get in touch with those fundamental questions. I think it's crucial for a kind of a leverage against, I think, the way a lot of us religious people function is our religion is a kind of a lever against whatever the conventional opinion is. So it's hard to disagree with what everyone else is saying, the conventional wisdom. And having a religion gives you it gives you some leverage, it gives you some help, it gives you some strength. It gives you a community where you can go to and say, am I crazy? Or does it seem like this thing that everyone says is okay is wrong? Or this thing that everyone says is wrong is really good.
Moral balanced.
So I do think it's very important. And I do think in the end that the intellect and faith can have a very rich interactive relationship. Even though for me, it didn't go intellect first. I've definitely grown a lot intellectually since I became religious, even though that wasn't the cause of my becoming religious.
Well, one more question on religious and faith and what people, what gives them comfort. What you just in your, one of the sections in your book that I found really interesting was about the Virgin Mary, and many of those like me who were not raised in Christian households have often viewed the mother of Jesus as a sweet-natured but vapid young girl, and later as a grieving mother, but nothing much beyond that. But in your book, Mary is portrayed, you show that in the Bible, she's portrayed as a surprisingly learned young person who knows her Old Testament. And centuries later, I heard a lecture that you also gave online, which I recommend that people Google, about the Mary, I guess the Virgin Mary as an intellectual force.
Yeah, the intellectual life of the Mother of God.
I really urge people to Google that and listen to it because it was really fascinating. But you said that you made the point that in centuries later, after many years into time, she's shown, especially in the medieval period, I believe she's depicted as holding a book. And I wonder, could you talk about the role that learning plays in the Virgin Mary's life, as not only as a young person, when she actually corrects Joseph or upbraids him for questioning her knowledge of the scriptures, but later on, you say that when she's grieving and Jesus is dead, that learning her welcoming of knowledge enables her to face this horrific experience. I believe I'm not getting that quite right, but I wonder you could discuss that.
So I think first of all, the question about Mary being an intellectual or being learned or being a bookworm, it's not actually biblical. It comes out of later traditions.
But she says something like, I will ponder these and I will think about
it. She ponders things in her heart. So she's definitely reflective. She ponders things in her heart. That's in the scriptures. She asks questions, you know, how can this be? So she's a serious, reflective person in the scriptures. But there's no mention of her reading or thinking or studying. What that appears in is a later tradition, not much later, truthfully. Origen, who's one of the earliest church fathers, describes her as being learned, and then that gets picked up and passed on into the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance. I think that's what's more fundamental than that, though, connects to something else that you said, which is that, you know, we think of her as being this nice lady, you know, who had a baby, and aren't we all glad? And isn't it cute? I think what is true, even in the Bible and behind the Bible, before you get to the question about her being intellectual, she's an extremely strong person. So if you think to the circumstances that she must have actually been facing, so she's a young woman, unmarried, and she's agreeing to be pregnant by mysterious means. Now, that is really something like a death sentence in her community. You know, you don't have sex outside of marriage. She's betrothed to Joseph. She's not supposed to be getting pregnant by someone else. So it's really something that is counter to the conventions of her time, and the strength of her consent, of her saying, yes, be it done to me according to thy word, that's a sign that you're dealing with a really extremely strong person with a very deep faith at the minimum. Now, what I like about the later tradition of her being a bookworm or an intellectual, I don't think Christians are required to believe that, but I think it can help you with your devotion.
What do you think the reason for that was? I mean, what was the motivation of the people that promulgated that view of her?
I think that they wanted her to have all the virtues, and especially in the late antiquity, intellectual virtues were central to faith. They were not as uncomfortable with thinking that. That being holy might be connected to one's understanding of things. So I think that's part of it. They wanted her to have all the virtues, and they recognized that the intellect, as we were just saying, is a source of strength. That is, if you are concerned with what's true and what's good, that gives you an anchor to make choices that isn't just doing what everyone expects you to do or everyone wants you to do. So I think that was part of it. And she was, Mary's meant to be a model for all believers. And, you have these bookworm monks who are scholars, and they look up to Mary as this model of someone who studied and had her study in the right order. So I think that's part of it. It's a way of bringing out an aspect of her humanity that people can relate to and aspire to. I think that's what's behind it.
Well, at this point, I'd like to remind listeners that we are talking today with Zena Hitz, author of the book Lost in Thought, The Hidden Pleasures of an Intellectual Life. And given that you were talking about being strong and where people find strength, you talk about the figure, the concept of dignity, and I'd like to read it. Your book is so full of passages. I wrote them out by, I typed them in. I said, okay, they could quote this because it should be quoted. Best say it better than I can. But you write movingly in the book about several figures, such as Malcolm X and political prisoners from Iron Curtain countries, for whom intellectual life was a lifeline in dehumanizing conditions and saved people from despair. You know, there was this phenomenon in Auschwitz that people just turned their face to the wall and just died because they just couldn't bear it anymore. But you say in the book, the inwardness of the mind at leisure unlocks the dignity that is so often diminished by social life and social circumstances. And elsewhere in the book, you write, it is worth trying to get at what dignity is and why it might belong in a special way to intellectual life. And circling back to the subject of asceticism, which we discussed earlier, asceticism, sacrifice and suffering, which you mentioned, suffering for the sake of some good is fundamental for our dignity. Could you discuss dignity?
Oh, wow. Okay, so this is a really hard, this is a really tough one. And I struggled with it in the book because on the one hand, it felt really right to me to say that, what is it that someone like Malcolm X, who's grows up in a very racist environment. His father's killed by, is murdered by white men. The welfare office breaks up his family. So someone who's really been diminished by his community and is in prison for theft. And prisoners in general are not, as one might hope, treated with as human beings. So what does he find? He finds in the books, he reads the whole prison library, as we know from his autobiography and more recent biographies, or the most of it. And by reading, he finds a sense of his own dignity and the dignity of others, I think, also. So there's this sense in which, he understands his worth. He understands that he's more than an animal who can be casually murdered or a a being that has to be caged and is ritually humiliated. He knows that he's someone who's capable of memorizing poetry and understanding human history and thinking about the fundamentals of life and pondering questions about the creation of the world and the nature of society and the history of racism. And that's all a source of human worth. It's something splendid about human beings that we can do this. We can think about things. We can find all of these depths in ourselves. So that's why I wanted to use a word like dignity, because I wanted to try to capture that and to capture why there are so many stories, some of which I collect in the book, of people from diminished backgrounds, people of working classes, people who work in the service industry, people who are the victims of prejudice, people who live under totalitarian regimes like fascism or Soviet communism. And these people have to struggle to find why they are valuable, what matters about them. And they find it through poetry and through thinking about things and through doing mathematics. They're in a way defending themselves from their environment. That's a start. I'm sure you can have more. You can come back at me with something.
Oh, well, good. Well, one aspect of it, yeah, you quote in the book from a study of working class, the intellectual life of the working class. I'm sure you could give the title of it. It was a very notable book. And
The British Working Classes, that's right. It's a 2001 book by a scholar named Jonathan Rose, who gives these, he collects these first-person accounts of these working people in Britain who, through grassroots intellectual programs or sometimes through middle-class outreach, they read books, they discover poetry, they study astronomy, and this whole world opens up for them that hasn't been available to them before.
Well, one thing I found interesting in that. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, please.
Oh, well, in that you quoted several of them, and one thing that was very tragic and touching about them was they felt as they began to be estranged from their own backgrounds or ashamed of their own backgrounds. And you talk about that you have experienced people manifesting that same phenomenon in American academia, or even I guess Anglo-American academia, because you've been in Cambridge as well, of people making fun of their own families because the book you talk about someone going back, well, that you quote in the Rose's book about a person going back to her working class home from Oxford and how ugly everything suddenly seemed. And she just was, but it was, everything was horrible and drab and dreary. And that was so sad. Because she, you know,
I know it really is sad. And it's also, as you just said, it's a reality that I feel like I've seen a lot of people in academia that I've met. A lot of them come from, now it's considered this really elite activity, but a lot of them come from really non-elite backgrounds. And some of them are, keep in touch with their non-elite backgrounds. They have some loyalty to it, but often it's, a deep rejection and connected with a certain kind of a shame from that. So that's part of what's tricky in that, I think the two questions we've just been talking, the question about dignity and the question about losing touch with your roots, intellectual life as a sort of route out of poverty, and so a route to contempt for your origins. You can feel the tension, I think. On the one hand, what are these people doing when they, rise from their working class families and go to Oxford and become comfortable in a different social class? Well, in a way, they're escaping from the diminishment of where they came from. In another way, the escape is not so much in their intrinsic dignity as human beings. It's a competitive escape. So they've escaped being low class by being higher class. And that's not, I think, in the end, a satisfying exchange. So one of the things I try to emphasize in the book is that the problem with status competitions, with competitions in social ranking, is that they actually diminish everybody. They diminish the people on the low end in an obvious way, the reject, the loser, the bottom of the heap. But if you're valued because of your athletic ability or because of your money or because of your good looks, or you're also being diminished. And that's why I think there are also stories of people who find their dignity through intellectual life from being extremely successful. There's something empty, there's something missing, and they find in the work of the mind some value that really belongs to them, that isn't just handed to them by the outside world. That also, I think, helps with the notion of dignity, that it's something which any competitive form of social life has the danger of diminishing, and that really, I think, everyone really craves some contact with a sense that their worth is built into them and is not conditional.
Well, I was going to save this to the end, but I think I'll read it now because you're talking about what about the intellectual life and what it can mean to people. And I think this is just an incredibly beautiful passage in your book that you wrote in the book. And I'd like to read it. And it's very, I hope I can do justice to it, but you talked about what the intellectual life can do for people. And you say, this is from the book, towards the end. Perhaps towards the end of the thing. What good is intellectual life? It is a refuge from distress, a reminder of one's dignity, a source of insight and understanding, a garden in which aspiration is cultivated, a hollow of a wall to which one can temporarily withdraw from the current controversies to gain a broader perspective, to remind oneself of one's universal heritage. All of this makes clear, at the least, that it is an essential good for human beings, even if one good among others. I wonder if you could discuss that term essential good a little bit.
Wow.
Is that too broad?
No, it's just difficult. I'm reeling at the difficulties. I think I say an essential good. It's a bit of a dodge. So you have a nose for the dodges. It's a bit of a dodge because part of me wants to say it's fundamental to every human life. It's the most important thing. But I'm trying to, trying to cast a wide net. I'm trying to reach a broad audience. And I think that doesn't fly with some people. So I just kind of step back and I say, well, it's essential good. There may be other really important things, but this is really important. So it's a kind of a hedge. Instead of saying it's the central most important thing, it's the key to human happiness, I say, well, at least it's as important as other things that we care about. I talk about this, I guess when I think about the hedge is worth making in a lot of cases because I don't want to say, for instance, that one should always and everywhere pursue the most intellectual activity one can. Sometimes a basic kind of service to one's neighbor is more important or more necessary. Sometimes you have to, you need to pay attention to, are the structures of your society just? Is the law being followed? Is the whole thing being put together in a good order? You need to think about growing food and delivering it to people. There's all kinds of dimensions to human life and all kinds of things that people need. I don't want to say that intellectual life is something superfluous in the sense that we can just forget about it and have a culture without it and we'll be fine. I think that that's not true. We need to have intellectual life along with creative life, along with religion and things like that. We need to have that so that there's something in which our lives culminate, for which all the feeding and the healthcare and the justice is for ultimately.
Well, you mentioned the question of audience, and you want to have an audience, not just academics, but general readers. And I can say, well, I'm a general reader, and I think many of the people who listen to the New Books Network are general readers. They're educated people who want. So, but in the book you write, learning and intellectual life are not the exclusive province of professional academics, but academics are their official guardians, and so a good place to begin renewal from. But I also hope that this book will fall into the hands of non-professionals with intellectual interests and they will recognize themselves in it. Perhaps we'll be even better off. We will be even better off if intellectual life is renewed from the grassroots. So I think your book is a good platform or a good argument for that.
Oh, thank you. Good. That was exactly what I wanted it to be. Good.
Well, and another aspect of the book that I think is really powerful is that it's timeless in the fact that you discuss the great, for example, Augustine, who was centuries ago, but you also, as I read it, even though you weren't addressing, this was written long before the coronavirus ever appeared on, I mean, it was in our radar, on our, yes, on the radar, as they say, but it was almost eerie reading sections of your book about it. It was really spooky almost. But I'd like to read some of those passages and show why this book is not only relevant now and but will be 10 years from now, or just for people who are interested in the intellectual life, but also why it is germane or relevant now to the situation with the political. First, I'll start off with the disease aspects of it. I'd like to read this section, which again is very prescient. You write of human fragility and of human beings, and then you say human beings can be, and then you say melted down from within by the invisible machinery of a busy, heartless contagion. And we and then you continue in another part of the book, it's later on in that passage, you write, we imagine that death is for beings inferior to us. We imagine our worth lies in health or the appearance of health, in pleasure or the public display of pleasure, in moving matters and matter in dramatic, spectacular ways, in compliments and cheering crowds. We think that through these things, we have become something different, something not made of flesh and blood, perhaps something perhaps shinier and more durable, something perhaps immaterial and ineffable. And then you also continue, imagining, reflecting, pondering the fact of one's own susceptibility to illness and death can be part of the most ordinary life. And you also say, and our humanity is not a profession to be left to the accomplished few. And I think that the accomplished few made me think of the fact that right now, every layperson is kind of at the mercy of, or the gentle ministrations of, the expert class, the public health officials, the governors, and we have very little agency at this point. And it's almost like we have to hunker down and just hope that everybody else, that particular group knows what he or she is doing. But I thought that was, and then if you don't mind, I'll go on with when you, that you're talking about the illness aspect, the disease aspect of it. But this is when you also go on about, and this is another spookily eerie, another prescient passage. You're right. And this, given our pandemic economic catastrophe, you write, I'm reading it as that, but you didn't write that as that. If there's nothing else to intellectual life, if it is only a sophisticated pleasure held in place by whatever supports a high status lifestyle, then it cannot change us. And you spoke earlier about change and being open to change. If it's nothing else, if it's only that, it remains a form of entertainment rather than a means of self-examination or personal transformation. Nor can it be a refuge when the conditions for wealth and comfort collapse, or if the institutions that support us in our lifestyles fall apart, or if we fail to meet their conditions, or if we are the victims of dramatic political or economic change. And I just went, whoa. It was like you had a crystal ball.
I didn't have a crystal ball. Just so you know, I didn't have a crystal ball. I do think that the last real explosion of writing about the life of the mind and the liberal arts and the great books and so on was around the middle of the 20th century. And that's a time when people are reflecting on the contingency of their societies, because you've had two world wars and a major depression, and things which seemed solid and certain and people who, like the Germans of the early 20th century, who seemed to be at the sort of the pinnacle of Western civilization, turned out to be capable of these unbelievable things. And, you know, whole cultures, families, countries rise and fall in ways that are dizzying and disorienting. So I think that part of, and I think it's also, frankly, part of what one learns by reading what are called the great books. They are stories of contingency and collapse. Thucydides on the Peloponnesian War, you know, he writes, the Athenians are the top of the heap. They're king of the mountain, and they make a few bad decisions, and the whole thing crumbles like dust. So I think I attribute it not to any special prophetic powers of mine, but just to the fact that I'm connected on a daily basis through my work with these old books, which are always telling us that the things we think are certain are not. And that, and also this tradition from the mid-20th century of reflecting on the humanities and the liberal arts and the great books in light of the massive contingencies that that modern life can't protect us from. We think they can, and it's part of what you're talking about too. You know, we think that somehow some expert's going to come in and sort out this global pandemic and just going to fix it. You know, and it's obvious they can't fix it. I mean, eventually we might come up with a vaccine and that would be great. But we've seen, I think, a lot of experts in the expert class say or do things that didn't seem grounded in the reality. And I think that's a scary prospect, you know, we can be ruled by people who don't know what they're doing. And so all to say, it was not prophetic. It was just, I think, part of the timeless themes of this kind of study, the contingency of things.
Well, on that note of the timelessness of it, you discuss in the book the virtue of seriousness, and again connecting it to the modern day of your teaching the students what is meant for centuries, but in the current health crisis, in terms of seriousness, is the economic and public health crises, are they burning that seriousness in millions of people who lacked it before? Or are we over-dramatizing the current situation? After all, staying home for a few months is hardly life in a concentration camp. What level of seriousness is called for? And do you happen to notice, are many people turning to escapist fare rather than serious reading? Is fluff called for rather than sterner stuff?
It's a great question. And the truth is, I just don't know. It's a question I've asked myself, you know, are we making too much of this? Is this really a worldwide global game changer? I think it has to be, if only for the economic reasons, which might have been the result of decisions that might have gone differently and could still go differently. It looks to me like the economic uncertainty is serious. And I do think, to me, I don't know, this has been my impression from this period of coronavirus, and it could change tomorrow. But my impression is that things pull in two different directions, this crisis. And on the one hand, you have this pull towards distraction, anything to keep your mind away from one's solitude, one's isolation, one's fear of the future, you know, so, you know, video games, pornography, anything, Netflix, anything to just distract. And on the other hand, a turn towards seriousness. So those things both seem to be going on at once. And I think probably sometimes in the same people and in the same places. But it pulls in two directions. It pulls towards a sort of what I would call the solidification of the rule of big tech over our inner lives. Here we are, we're at home, and we can't even get groceries without using the computer, you know, or entertain ourselves. We can't go to the movies anymore. It's all through streaming. So there's a way in which everything becomes more centrally controlled, and there's another way in which things fall apart and people are imagining and creating new kinds of possibilities because they can't rely on the old ways anymore. So I don't know which of those two things is going to prevail or how they interact or anything like that. That's just what I've seen, I feel like, in the past couple of months.
Well, one aspect that I thought was interesting, you invited me to say, push you a little bit, and you're very critical in the book of Twitter, and yet you're on Twitter.
I am on Twitter all the time.
I think it's a wonderful combination in your Twitter feed of the fact that it's serious links to serious pieces of thoughtful writing. Plus, you had when I was working with my mother in the garden yesterday, I said, I saw a really good tweet about, it's not effective when you're weeding to think of it as being, my garden needs weeding. You have to think of each individual weed as an enemy that must be destroyed. Exactly. I found that much more effective. I said, I'm getting that one. He's going to die right now. And I thought, but you make the point that Twitter can be a very ugly place, but oftentimes it's where thoughtful people like you tweet to substantive, intellectually engaging work, or just make clever points.
Well, so I want to say that I don't think I'll often have the chance to make this kind of defense. I want to take the opportunity. I do want to confess. I think that part of my current attachment to Twitter is out of a kind of a weakness. That is, I'm quarantined. I live by myself, and it's just a wonderful way to entertain myself. It's my particular chosen form of distraction to a certain extent. I also think that over time I found it quite difficult, and I'm sure others have found it difficult. One of the modes of Twitter, just as the mode of Facebook or in general our news media, it's very much outrage generated. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we want to feel outraged. We look out for the stories that outrage us. That I think is very dangerous to us intellectually and morally. We should be concerned with looking for what's edifying or what might be changed for the better, or rather than getting stuck in an emotional condition where everything is terrible and we're constantly in a dramatic emotional reaction to it. So over years. Frankly, on social media, I've trained myself not to react to outrage or to pass on outrage. Every now and then, I feel the pull again, but that's part of it. The other thing is that I think the truth is, and I want to say this too, when I started writing this book. When I actually wrote that first essay, which was the root of it, it was published in First Things about 5 years ago, I felt very much alone in the world. I would read articles about higher education, and I would think, wow, am I the only person who thinks that reading and thinking is really worth doing for its own sake? You know, am I the only person who thinks that maybe directing everything towards what's useful or what's political is a mistake? Am I the only person that thinks that community really matters for intellectual life? And what I've discovered through things like Twitter and also just through writing in general is how many people are out there who are sympathetic and who are thinking about the same things. I think that's the gift of social media, if it's used properly, is a way of finding people out there in the world who care about the things that you care about. And you can encourage one another and give each other ideas and help one another. And that's great. That's performing something of the function, I think, in intellectuals used to write letters, you know, they had a massive correspondence, you'd write letters to strangers and they might write back. And so we've lost that, but I think this is a kind of a substitute. It's a way of making connections, with people who care about the same things. And I've really enjoyed that actually about Twitter, these past months.
Well, I encourage people to Google your name and the word Twitter, and they'll find you pretty easily. I enjoy it. But one of the things that you talk about, and we discussed this earlier about getting away from the primacy of politics and making everything political, and yet again, I'll press you a little bit on that. In your book, I'll read the names of the people that some of the people you discuss: Dorothy Day, Antonio Gramsci, Malcolm X, Simone Weil, and those were inherently, I mean, those were political animals, many of them were. That's what, I mean, they might have dressed a lot of it up in philosophy and so forth and scholarship, but who was more political than Tony Gramsci and Dorothy Day? I mean, she founded basically what is sort of a quasi-political party, the Catholic Workers' Party, and she wrote editorials. It wasn't as though she was not engaged politically.
Yeah, but, you know, it's funny. You're absolutely right to notice that tension. And part of it, I have to think carefully about how I want to answer it. I do think that part of what I wanted to do, I suppose, was when I first started writing about this, I was very emphatic, very, very emphatic that intellectual life mattered not because it was politically useful, but because of what it did for human beings, the way it changes us and the way it helps us to grow. And that would be true regardless of any political effects. And that was, I think, the part of the view that is most controversial, frankly, because we live in such a political age. And, you know, because of modern media, we constantly have in our faces 10 trillion injustices, which seem worthy of remedying. And it seems self-indulgent to sit in your library and read books all the time. And I myself, as a graduate student, was tortured by this thought that somehow what I was doing was useless and I needed to be addressing the suffering of the world. So well, what I love about these figures of Dorothy Day and Malcolm X, in Gramsci's case, I think is a little more, there's a bit of a tension in Gramsci that I try to suggest in the book. And I'm not a Gramsci expert. And so I put it out there in the hopes that someone else will work it out. He seems to be saying, even though he thinks on principle that all intellectual work is political, he seems to be saying that what he's doing in prison is cultivating himself and his inner life and something eternal. And that's a tension in him. So I just wanted to say that, but go ahead and come back with what you wanted to ask about.
Well, you were mentioning the fact that going out into the world and engaging and so forth, and a large part of your book or a section of it is about the 1941 Preston Sturges film Sullivan's Travels. And
that's right.
I mentioned to you in an email that that you and I see this completely differently, and I think that's probably a good indication that it's a great film. So because you see it as that. I'll tell you how I see it, and then you can tell me that you can correct me because I'd be interested to see what your reaction is. My reaction was, this film is a combination of screwball comedy and social commentary and poverty and political and economic equality. You write of it quite approvingly, and at the end of the film, to me, the film director hero, after seeing the poor and social injustice close up, decides that he can best serve humanity by making Hollywood comedies. Now, right. To me, isn't that the quintessential self-serving Hollywood liberal argument? Preston Sturges seems to be saying, golly, there are poor people in America. I had better continue my career in Hollywood making frothy comedies and form an alliance with the tycoon Howard Hughes, which he did. Am I completely wrong here? I mean, it's like Preston Sturges said, I mean, that's virtue signaling to the max. And that, and in his own life, I mean, Preston Sturges did not quit to go teach high school math in rural Oklahoma, right? He stayed in Hollywood and in Broadway theater for the rest of his life. And it was like, okay, I'm going to make this really funny film and these are poor people, but I'm not going to align myself other than making a film out of them.
So you definitely have a point. The ending of the movie where filmmaker Sullivan, having had his little experience of being poor, goes back to his mansion and makes comedies, and you think, well, this might be a little self-serving, a conclusion that somehow living in his mansion is just as good or even better than really helping people. I guess I think this. Part of what I wanted to take from the film was this hilarious send-up of how inefficacious our attempts as middle class or as wealthy people are to encounter the experiences of the poor, and how
quickly, you talk about Simone Weil in that respect.
Yeah,
too, that
how quickly they fall into sort of a parody, or you know, or even something patronizing, or sort of you're interested in the spectacle of yourself, you know. Being poor, you want to kind of possess their suffering, but you actually can't do that because the only way to be poor is to be poor. So that I think is brilliant about the movie. I think the thing that I wanted to take from it, and I think you're right that there's room to disagree considering the ending, but I do think that it's true what Sullivan says at the end, that somehow thinking that making comedy is silly and trivial, because, which is how he is at the beginning of the movie, making comedy is silly and trivial because of all the suffering in the world. You've got to make films about suffering. And realizing through his journey that comedy really does matter, which I think it does. I mean, making people laugh, that really matters. It's really important. It's fundamental. And so in my view, he's moving away from the sort of more typical Hollywood virtue signaling. You know, this is a movie that, you know, unveils the oppression with which we all live in. I'm using my voice to be a voice for the oppressed, which never seems to work very well. It's clunky, it's patronizing. That he's discovered something different, which is that comedy is worthwhile. So I wanted to say that something like that's true for for intellectual life, that is, it's worthwhile spending your life writing commentaries on Aristotle. It's not self-indulgent. You're helping people maintain a piece of their humanity. Now, that's not to say that, I personally, as a Catholic, I think living in a big Hollywood mansion and making comedies for the poor is hypocritical. I think you have to also sacrifice your time and your treasure to the actual people in your community who are suffering. So comedy is not enough, but there is an insight there. I don't know if you find that convincing or not, but that's my defense of my my reading of Sullivan's Travels.
Well, I hope that you will continue to be interviewed about film, because I think you're a very gifted film critic as well as a...
Oh, thank you.
Because I didn't know there was so much depth in that film. So now I'd like to conclude by asking, given that you do address an academic audience and the general public on the state of American academia, I'd like to talk about your concern about the fact that everything is that students are engaged in sort of this mass, they're not getting personal attention enough. And you write, and this is very strong, you write, it is a disgrace to our system of higher education that person-to-person teaching belongs only to a handful of liberal arts colleges and to elite doctoral programs. But I would point out, and I'm sure you know this, obviously, that's extremely labor-intensive and therefore a highly, hugely expensive proposition. But you say that academics have lost the capacity to justify and explain to our fellow citizens or to philanthropists, much less to ourselves, why our institutions matter. And you again, circling back to your own life story, that you left the fast track of, extremely prestigious positions in major universities to go to where you were educated as a young person yourself, and you're finding it very rewarding. And if I had a college age student, I'd want you to be their teacher, actually. Oh, that, or her teacher. But I wonder if you want to conclude on the state of higher education, and what do you think? Again, I know I'm belaboring the coronavirus issue, but it seems to be in the air that there is a sea change coming, and that many small liberal arts colleges are in the buzzword of the day is existential crisis.
Yeah.
So how do you see, and also do you see that is there any value in the fact that if these young and you made a point about how so many institutions of higher education are dependent on this highly exploitative situation of adjunct teaching.
Right.
And could it be that those people become severed from what you say is sometimes a rather corrupting and also just a dead end anyway, intellectually, because they're not able to teach. They're just on the highway migrating between and, teaching these classes, these enormous classes. Right. And so how can you put on your prognosticator hat again? Or
Well, I've actually, it's helpful to talk about it because I'm writing a piece for the Chronicle Review about this right now. So and it's a little bit, I feel somewhat like I'm stepping out on a limb because I've worked in a lot of institutions of higher education and different kinds, liberal arts colleges as well as research universities and public as well as private, and I've been in universities in different countries and so on. I do think quite strongly that learning in its most basic form, and this is whether you're talking about learning dance, learning music, learning karate, learning science, learning engineering, learning math, learning philosophy, it is fundamentally at its best person to person. It's habits of mind that are passed on with feedback between a teacher and a student. The teacher says something, the teacher tries, the student tries it, the teacher gives feedback, and so on. So I think that that's true, and so there's a way in which I want to say very rhetorically, well, colleges can't afford not to do this, expensive as it is. So part of me wants to say that what I'm seeing right now is, again, with coronavirus, and here I think it really is relevant because I think it we are likely in the middle of a kind of catastrophe for higher education, not just liberal arts colleges. But of course, these big universities, Johns Hopkins and Notre Dame and Harvard and Stanford, these are all places which are facing tens of millions of dollars in shortfalls. So the whole system, it seems to me, is in a kind of crisis. And the government may intervene, but we don't know how, and we don't know what's going to happen. So I see, two strands. One pressure is towards making everything as cheap as possible. Okay, so that's the pressure which is most dramatic is towards moving to online learning. One of the things I think that's remarkable that's happened in the past couple of months is that this is what I think many people thought was inevitable. We were all going to move to online learning. It's so much cheaper. Is it really any worse? And at the very beginning of the crisis, that was my greatest fear. I thought we're going to go online and we'll never come off again. And what's happened is that the students across the country have delivered a verdict, which is that they do not like online learning and they do not want to pay for it. So in a certain way, it's a case where the market, which, you know, academics like me are not always a fan of, but in this case, it's really spoken. The students do not want online learning. They want in-person learning.
Just to be devil's advocate, is it possible it's not the learning, it's the issue, but the social networking that they do when they're, I mean, you can't, if you're, say, at Yale or Harvard, a lot of it is connecting with your students and building your network of associates that will help you get the cushy jobs later. Is it really that they're rebelling? Are they just saying, I'm not going to pay $60,000 a year or you know, 100 or more for not that social cachet that I get, that I'm not getting?
So I hear the devil's advocate. I think two things. For one thing, having just spent some weeks doing online teaching, it is unquestionably much more boring to be in an online class for students and for teachers than to be in an in-person class. It's much harder to bring the energy, to have the spontaneity, to have enthusiasm catch fire. Just everything feels like pulling. So that's one thing.
Now, I just wanted to say that I heard a woman say that her granddaughter is saying that online education is making her work harder because before she could just sit and listen to a lecture, and now the professor is saying, "Well, I want you to do all these online assignments," and that's more taxing for the students.
It can be, but I'm going to stand by. I think it's really the students have not liked. There's even lawsuits, you know, that students have lodged against universities for providing an inferior product for the same price. But let me get back to your question about networking, which I think is actually kind of crucial, because I think that networking is really a diminishment. Calling it networking is a diminishment of the kind of thing that happens in college. What happens in college is forms of friendship. And often, especially at a place like St. John's, which is an intellectual school, it's intellectual friendship. So our students learn a lot from one another. They're part of a community of learning, as we used to call it. We assign very difficult material, and they work together on it. They help each other figure it out. And then they come to class. Then they talk to each other about what happens in class. So yes, there's a way in which this has an economic effect of networking. And frankly, I've taken advantage. I've gone to college with very accomplished people, and they've helped me out. I mean, networking is a real phenomenon, but it's that social world where you're building friendship. It's a time that's set apart for you to grow personally, intellectually, to reflect on what you want to do with your life, to be out of your parents' house, for at least for middle-class students. I mean, that's not the norm in all higher education, but it is true for the, you know, the liberal arts colleges and the more elite institutions. You're away from your parents. You're living a kind of new, and that's very attractive. But it's connected to learning in real life and the excitement and the spontaneity that comes when you are in the classroom with a person who really cares about what they're teaching. That's transmitted.
Have you had students write you and say, "I miss you, Professor"?
They didn't contact me directly, but there were seas of complaints about online learning that went straight to our dean and our president. Our students really hated it and resisted it all the way. So, anyway, I think, to get back to the future of higher education, I think there's two possibilities. One, I mean, they could mix, but one possibility is everything becomes very centralized, very cheap, very automated. I think that's a disaster for higher education. I mean, I think certain kinds of professional training can be done that way. But I think if you look at, I was reading an article, this was secondary school, not college. You can get away with things in secondary school because people don't necessarily choose under the same terms to be there. A school in New York where one teacher teaches online 112 ninth graders in seven sections of ninth grade geometry. Now, that's not a scenario where a lot of personal feedback and attention is going to take place. There may be good things about that setup. So hiring could move in that direction. I think that would be very bad. It could reform in the way that I hope it would by asking itself what matters about it, which is teaching and learning and studying and trying to find institutions which restructure institutions in a way that those things become more central. There's a lot of waste and a lot of ridiculousness in our universities. There's insanely high salaries paid to high-end administrators, med school professors, law school professors, hotshot humanities professors. We have old practices for the competition and prestige where, you know, you fly in some hotshot scholar from Europe for 1 month out of the year to teach a little class, and you pay them six figures for that. So there's tons of waste and unnecessary prestige wrangling. There's a lot of elements of a university that are in themselves profitable, which would probably be better off as independent businesses. So athletics, for instance, or hospitals. You know, these people get millions of dollars in salary. I was looking at the list of salaries of Maryland State employees the other day. And of course, the top 25, 30, 40, it's people at universities, coaches and med school professors and administrators. You get to the governor, sort of way, way down the list, you know, gets paid a paltry $180,000 for being
the coach, of course, would argue, well, I bring in, I don't know the figures of how they balance out. But.
Of course. So these are supposed to be in the hospitals too. They're revenue generating. But what are we hearing? Well, athletics is losing money and hospitals are losing money. So why don't we start, you know, if these are really money-making, why don't these salaries follow the way of the revenue of those sectors?
You know, absolutely.
So there's a lot of waste and inconsistency and cruddy thinking. And I think we can't really talk about the cost of something like person-to-person learning until we've really taken a hard look at all of those costs. One thing that I think may happen, which would involve also a lot of sacrifice, although also something interesting, I think we might be looking in both secondary education, primary and secondary, and at higher education, at a kind of growth of a freelance, grassroots kind of a market. So it's not going to take much for people to figure out that they can hire a private tutor, or a bunch of families can get together and hire a professor to teach their children things without the overhead, without the administrative costs, without this, without that. I would not be surprised if that started to take shape.
Concierge education.
Exactly. There's a lot of loss to it. We'd have to think about what kind of access the poor would have to education like that. How could poor people like me, assuming that I'm one of these people, how do people make a living at the outset? So it's sort of gig economy type work. But I do think that universities are approaching a point where it's not obviously the best way to get the thing that you want if what you want is to learn. And it may not be the best way even to get what you want in terms of research. After all, a lot of that research is profitable. It could be funded by private companies. So anyway, that's a bunch of a pastiche of thoughts about the future of higher education. But I do think it's a cliche, but it's a very terrifying crisis for people involved in higher education. It really feels like a catastrophe. But there is also opportunity in a crisis like that. And the people who have come to recognize what really matters about a university, it's time to get to the barricades and fight for it.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if the left is a little neutered, because they so much of it is sort of a re-education camp that people are saying, I don't want my kid to emerge as a young Karl Marx necessarily. That's my take.
I think that's a bit, in my experience in the universities, it's a bit exaggerated. There's some brainwashing, progressive brainwashing. There's also some conservative brainwashing. I think a lot's going on that's not political, but it is. There's no question that universities have a bad image and colleges have a bad image, and you take something out of the equation, like the in-person aspect of it, and the prospect of paying $50,000 or $60,000 or $70,000 or even $30,000 to send your child to a place like that becomes a lot less attractive.
It's a fascinating real world test case of what technology can do and what reform under the gun can
Exactly. Yeah. Well, this is, I think, how probably all real reform takes place. It probably all takes place under the gun. If we have that to say that's positive about it.
Well, Zina, I've taken up a lot of your time, and I was going to ask you the traditional final question on the New Books Network, and that's what is you working on now? But I think you just answered that. You're writing an article about this matter.
Yes, so. That will be done pretty soon. I actually have two book projects as it exists.
Okay.
One is on, it's for a series, it's called A Philosopher Looks at Various Topics. So I'm writing a short essay about
publisher is that?
Cambridge. It's under review. It's not final yet, but A Philosopher Looks at Religious Life. So I'm going to be writing about the life of a monk, the life of a monk, monastic life, and how that might be seen as something on the one hand that's human, a part of a desire for virtue, part of a desire for happiness. And on the other hand, to try to separate out what might be unworldly or different about that. So that's one project. The other project I have is a bit bigger and grander. It's about a phenomenon called moral fragility, the idea that we're not really in control of our moral condition. So morality is real and it matters and it accrues to individuals, but it depends on so many tiny circumstances, and so many decisions can change one's moral future in a way that's hard to foresee. So that's also an essay type book. I'll look at some literature.
Kind of like Lord Jim contemplating the lifeboat, and he has to make a snap decision that affects the rest of his life.
Exactly. So there's a lot of stories in literature like that, and a lot of philosophical stories, and I'm excited about that project too.
Oh, good. Well, I hope that you will get in contact with us, and we will be delighted to just discuss when they're ready.
Well, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. I really enjoyed this conversation. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to everyone listening. So.
And with that, thank you. It's been a delightful. I will just thank the scholar we've been talking to today, Zina Hitz, author of Lost in Thought, The Hidden Pleasures of an Intellectual Life. And thank you, listeners. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye. Thank you.